I saw this cute guy, and I said to my friends, he's mine. And I went down, I introduced myself, and I got him. It was as simple as that.
And she was cute, so I responded very positively. We've been married 3 times. We eloped, we got remarried, and last year in the town of Palm Beach, they had a ceremony for 80 people and people who wanted to renew their vows. We were the couple of honor because we were married so long.
Meet the Lebos.
Erwin Lebo. I was born March 27th, 1922, and I'm now 98 years of age.
Judith Lebo. I was born December 25th, 1923, and I'm 90, sort of forget. 96, something like that.
I interviewed the Lebos at their home, and the reason that's notable is because we were in the middle of the COVID pandemic, and they invited me to their house rather than do a remote interview. They did not request that I take a COVID test before I visited, but I did take one just to be safe. And when I rang the bell, both Lebos bounded to the door with the physical energy of people half their age. They had young energy. Both Erwin and Judy were put together, if you know what I mean, well-dressed and well-groomed. And although it was our first time meeting in person, they invited me into their home like they were receiving an old friend.
I played golf, I played tennis, bowling, I was part of a bowling team.
So you still play tennis? When was the last time?
Tuesday, and I play tomorrow morning.
Do you ever win?
Most times. We play doubles. And at this point in my game, most of the guys I play with are in their 80s. But we're all on a level, you know. They let us play in groups depending upon our ability. So, you know, if the ball is a little short sometimes, so we don't kill ourselves going for it.
By virtue of an early marriage and the good fortune of long lives, Erwin and Judy have been married near 80 years. Imagine being married to a single person for longer than most people get to live. Think about the probability of being around one person for 80 years and still relishing their company. As a culture, we tend to be pretty cynical about the prospect of romantic love enduring over time and through obstacles, and for good reason. Roughly 50% of marriages end in divorce, and among those that stay together, marital dissatisfaction is pretty common. Love, this fundamental domain of human existence, remains something of a mystery. Love, particularly the long-lasting kind, has been called one of the most studied and least understood areas in psychology. Over the years, the Lebos have weathered the stressors that tend to fray other marriages: financial strain, illness, even a tremendous and unexpected loss. The Lebos have had to deal with it. And although they did their best to conceal it, I learned they are facing a new challenge today. Yet, their union remains happy. And the reason for that is far more involved than just picking the right person. I'm Leslie Gold. This is A Life's Story.
How old were you when you met?
I was 16 going on 17, and you were 15 going on 16.
Wait a minute. Have you been together? Did you ever break up in that period and come back together? Or have you been together since you're 15?
Yeah, we did have a one-week breakup. We had been dating for 3 years. And I had graduated DeWitt Clinton High School, and I was going to NYU at night. And I had signed up for a New York State apprentice program in a defense plant. And I had to complete the program in 1 year, but I always wanted to be a pilot. So I enlisted in the Army Air Corps, and I was accepted. I told them that I couldn't come until I finished that program I was in. It was tied onto New York State. In fact, the draft couldn't even touch me. But the minute the program ended, I enlisted in the Army Air Corps and was told that I had to wait 6 months to be called for training. So I propositioned Judy. She said no. So I said, well, okay, so let's get married.
His proposition was he wanted to stay at the Astor Hotel with me. I said no. Things were different 77 years ago.
So we eloped to Elkton, Maryland. We got there and found out we needed a license. So we got the license. We came back 2 weeks later, January 30th, and got married. Came home and told our folks. February 14th, Valentine's Day, 1943, we were remarried. And 4 days later, I got a telegram to report to the Army Air Force Training Center.
Wow. Short honeymoon.
Irwin went through training and was assigned to the 27th Fighter Group as a P-47 Thunderbolt pilot. The 27th was a group that had been sent to Pearl Harbor just 5 days before the Japanese attacked, and they were wiped out. The group had been reactivated for the purpose of dropping bombs to support Allied troops in Europe.
Did you see combat?
I flew 93 missions in Europe as a dive bomber. Our planes were equipped with 8 50 caliber machine guns, 4 in each wing, and they were calibrated to come together 300 yards in front of the plane. So the idea was to hit your target when you're 300 yards away, where you'd get the most explosive benefit. And one day, I caught a locomotive at 300 yards and literally blew it off the tracks. We were flying missions into Italy, France, and then finally we were moved into Germany. My fighter group became the support group for General Patton's tanks. I'm very proud. We were in a terrific group. We received 5 presidential citations.
It's clear Irwin is quite proud of his military service, and with good reason. The 27th Fighter Group was the top-scoring unit of the 1st Fighter Group in World War II, with 83 of its pilots credited with 176 victories. And the 27th Fighter Group was the only fighter group to get those 5 presidential citations. Irwin has also received the Legion of Honor from the French government.
Was there ever a point during this period when you're saving the world for democracy? Mm-hmm. Was there ever a point where you thought, I'm not coming home?
Not me. When I first joined the group, I must admit I was scared the first few missions because, you know, I was now in combat, even though I had been trained. This was a whole different world. But after a while, it was a job. I was 22 years old. My wingman was a 19-year-old kid who had lied about his age.
Did you lose any of your colleagues in your unit?
Yes. In fact, I told you I was picked to fly the 500,000 sortie for the 12th Air Force. It was supposed to be what they called a milk run, an easy mission. And we were supposed to dive bomb machine gun nests on the Italian coast, come back because the newsreels were going to take pictures of General Cannon giving me the award. As we were diving on the target, Lieutenant Young in the plane in front of me was hit, and unfortunately he crashed into the side of the hill. So, you know, you see that happening, and we saw it a number of times, guys getting shot down. But I never thought it would happen to me.
You were right. Judy, were you aware of his dangerous assignment during the war?
Oh, yes, and I worked for the Naval Air Force when he was I worked at Floyd Bennett Field. I used to process all the cute little naval cadets coming in, learning to be fighter pilots. So I was really aware because we got the news every day on what was happening. News that wasn't out to the public, we got in our office. They were being shot down. The infantry was being shot at and killed. It was a very scary time. I was scared for him and for all the boys. All the boys I knew were someplace during the war.
Right.
And it was a very scary time.
How were you two communicating during that time?
They had special mailing pieces that we sent.
You would write it out and give it to the Postal Service. They would photograph it, and it would be on a disc, and they would send the disc back to this country and then print out all the letters that were on the disc, and then they would be delivered to wherever. So a plane could bring back 1,000 letters, or, you know, on one disc.
It was called V-mail, not female. V-mail, short for Victory Mail, and it was a hybrid mail process used by the United States during the Second World War as a primary and secure method to correspond with soldiers stationed abroad. To reduce the cost of transferring an original letter through the military postal system, a V-mail letter would be first read by a third party just in case it contained sensitive information and needed to be censored. The rest of the letters were miniaturized and copied to film. Then, when the microfilm arrived at its overseas destination, the letters were printed in smaller form on black and white paper. V-mail was actually strategic to the war effort. It ensured that thousands of tons of shipping space could be reserved for war materials.
Letters from home. Each day, millions of them are sent to American servicemen fighting on distant battlefronts. Because of a war postal system called V-mail, they can be flown throughout the world, reaching distant points safely and with amazing speed. This plane is landing in Italy. Each bag of mail it carries contains 136,000 letters. Back in America, each letter was reduced to a tiny strip of film.
Do you happen to remember when he returned?
Oh my God, that was probably the most exciting day in my life. Number one, he came home unhurt and alive and unhurt, which was sort of an oddity in those days. And his just coming home and my having him back again. He wasn't with a little French girl. He wasn't with a little German girl. He came home to me.
The war is over, and although they had been married now for a couple of years, the Lebos can only now really begin their marriage. They end up in Levittown. Levittown. Now, I have to mention a bit of the history of Levittown. Levittown is in Nassau County, New York, and it's a hamlet that was planned and constructed from about 1947 to 1951. Named after its founder, Abraham Levitt, and his two sons, Bill and Al, they mass-produced houses that could be quickly constructed. Over 30 of these one-floor homes with, quote, expansion attics could be constructed in a day. Levittown was built to meet the demand to provide affordable housing for returning GIs.
Took a ride out there, and we made arrangements to rent a little house. It was only for veterans. We were able to rent a two-bedroom house for $57 a month because it was for veterans. And we moved out there in 1947, I'm sorry. And our parents came out to visit and they looked around, what are you living in a slum? Because there was building going on all over the place. At any rate, we were happy there. In shortly, and Levitt raised the rent to $65 a month. I thought there was going to be a revolution with all the veterans.
Homes cost around $8,000 in Levittown by the end of the 1940s, and the GI Bill reduced this cost even further. Now, the median price of a Levittown home today is about $500,000. By the time it was completed, Levittown had about 17,000 homes, virtually all the same, and Levittown is widely considered to be the first modern American suburb.
And years later, I heard about an opening at Bill Levitt's newspaper in town, and I went and I got the job. And I was the advertising manager of the Levittown Tribune, working for Bill Levitt for, gee, 3 or 4 years or more, until a competitor of mine was shutting down his newspaper, and I was approached to start another newspaper in Levittown. So I left my job at Bill Levitt Paper to start the Levittown Press, which was a successful newspaper in Levittown for many years, until finally the economic pressure of running it against Bill Levitt's paper was too much.
Hi, it's Leslie. I hope you are enjoying this episode of A Life's Story so far. We can do this for you. We'll produce a personal audio documentary for a beloved family member. We will capture their life story and present it in a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that you and your family will treasure for years to come. Details are at the very end of this episode. Things were tough for a while. The Lebos had 3 kids, all boys, Ron, Barry, and Eric, and money was tight. Oldest son Ron Lebo remembers these times vividly. He remembers his childhood as a time the family had to scrimp and save.
When we were growing up, we didn't have a lot of money. My father was working very hard to build his business. He started out with a local weekly newspaper, and then from that branched into a direct mail service because of the mailing lists he established for the newspaper. And he would work 6 or 7 days a week, which did cause some friction in the house between he and my mother. At the time, we never knew that. We never realized that there was tension in the house because of my father's work hours. And the other thing that my parents did that always sticks with me, again, not having a lot of money, we would go to the beach on Saturday or Sunday afternoons, and they would kind of make it an adventure to go late in the day. The reality was we would go late in the day because that's when they stopped collecting the tolls to get into the beach. So we didn't have to pay the toll. But as a kid, I thought this was just a wonderful experience. You know, hanging out at the beach late in the day when watching the sunset, not having any money. My father working, my mother being the typical homemaker back in the early 50s, would make do with what he could bring home. I remember she used to tear our napkins in half. And I don't know, as a kid, you know, she would give me half a napkin. And I remember asking her once, why do I only get half? And she said, because that's all you need. And again, this is what she did to save money.
The lean years went on for a while, but Irwin eventually changed the focus of the company from newspapers to direct mail, and things turned around.
I was very successful in the industry. I built a big business. We had a plant with over 100 employees. The business, unfortunately, isn't there because the whole industry changed. I retired in 1992.
The Lebos then moved to Florida, where they hit another rough patch on money for a while, and Irwin came out of retirement in his 70s and got his realtor's license and sold homes to supplement their income. When a rough patch came, these two figured out a way to get through it, together. In their new community, the Lebos got noticed and made friends by showing off their young energy. Close friend Magdalena Andrade.
I met first Irwin Lebo at the tennis court. We have a program called the tennis pool games. So in the pool games, they match you up with different groups of people. Okay, so depending upon of your level of... So I ended up in the same court with Irwin. So I was so surprised because he ran to get the ball and he made good shots. And he is 98. So I saw him on the dancing floor, Judy and Irwin having a ball. They were dancing the night away. I approached them to say hello, and I introduced myself to Judy because I just had met him. So we got really connected.
Then another test. Youngest son, Eric, gets ill.
And I believe they thought everything was going to be fine. We kind of knew it didn't sound as promising to me as it did to my parents, but we didn't say anything. In conversations with my parents, I tried to kind of signal that maybe this wasn't going to be the best prognosis. We realized that he was in stage 4 melanoma. It was starting to metastasize and spread through different parts of his body, and it didn't look good. And my father, typical of his attitude, says, well, you know what? He's young. They should be able to take care of it. My mother was worried. She was worried all along. You know, she would cry in the evening. She couldn't understand how this could be happening.
It was cancer that settled in his liver, right? And he was at Sloan Kettering, where the treatment was unbelievable, but unfortunately, they couldn't save.
Yeah, I guess my sister-in-law, Nancy, who you met, called about 1 o'clock Friday morning and said, he just died. So I told my parents. My mother was hysterical. My father was crying. My mother was saying the whole time that I can't believe this is happening. This shouldn't be happening.
It's clear to me, sitting in the Lebo's home, that the wound of Eric's death is still raw. There were tears almost immediately. No one was eager to talk about it, but it was also clear to me that this was a pivotal event in their lives.
In the natural order of things, parents are not supposed to outlive their children. It strikes me as a special kind of grief.
It's indescribable.
Losing a child's got to be one of the most devastating events that can befall a family. It can also change the texture of a family as well, right? And some people, I think, maybe are able to make peace with it. You never get over it, but maybe make peace with it, and some people never can. Maybe you can talk about how you worked, work through the grief, the tremendous grief.
No, and, well, it was devastating. It was terrible. But, you know, I had two other sons. I had grandchildren. I think we were beginning to have great-grandchildren. You know, the family was intact. And, look, it's still, I think of him all the time.
Yes.
And it was terrible.
At that point, my mother changed. Something in my mother changed. She started to forget things. She was very mopey, weepy. She was getting continuous headaches. She was getting dizzy spells. My father, over the last several years, took her to all kinds of neurologists and all kinds of tests to basically find out there's really nothing physically wrong or nothing that could be done physically. I relate it all back to my brother dying. And that was the big change in her, to the point where now she's getting senile. She's forgetting. She doesn't remember from one minute to the next. You know, she will have these flashes of memory, but when we're there, we were going to Cousin Amy for dinner. She would ask 4 or 5 times in the morning, what are we doing tonight? Don't we have to prepare dinner? What do you want to do for dinner? And we keep repeating, we're going to Cousin Amy.
Their friend Magdalena also noticed a change.
She got somewhat depressed because she was telling me, my son could not die before than me. I'm the one that was supposed to be going first.
We would sit here at the end of a day, or not around this table in our other house, and Judy would invariably be crying. And no, there's nothing wrong with that. And it was sad, but we would constantly remember this thing that he did or that thing.
It was almost like a switch turning after my brother died, and she started to perform as if she had dementia. My father deals with this every single day, and we call him now the saint, because she will ask him 10 times during the course of the day, what day is it? What are we doing today? Do we have any plans? And he'll answer her as if it's the first time she asked.
I was a bit awed by that. That's love. That's a deep, unbreakable bond. When you can cheerfully repeat the same information to the same question over and over again as if it's the first time you've said it, wow. I venture to say not many of us could do that for very long.
For Erwin, you know, he's a really good trooper. He's been there next to her, and he's been giving her so much support, trying to make her feel better.
Now, of course, I just met this couple, but I wondered why I didn't detect any of this in Judy.
Other than her claim of being dizzy and having headaches, she seems okay. When they have a function, many times my father will have to really coax her to do it. She gets dressed up. When they get there, my father says, she's like a different person. She'll greet people. She remembers names. She reminds him of who he's talking to. So she gets herself up for these events. But unfortunately, now they're few and far between.
And then I remembered just one small thing from the start of our interview where there was a quiet assist from Erwin. You have to really listen to hear it.
Judith Lebo. I was born December 25th, 1923. And I'm 90, I sort of forget.
Going on 97.
96, something like that.
So I wondered, with their intermittent but very real struggles over the years, first years of physical separation, the finances, loss of a child, and now perhaps a failing memory, how is it the Lebos are still quite delighted to be in each other's company after 80 years together? Ron, what do you think has been the key to them having such a successful marriage for so long?
One thing I believe is going through some of the struggles that they did in the early years together.
Magdalena.
So they have this love and this connection to be with each other, that they trusted so much each other, and they were able to survive anything until today. When we go out for dinners here to the club, they hold hands like teenagers. Isn't that sweet?
So it's not that they endured despite their struggles. It's because of the struggles. Taking on the struggles and getting through them creates that unbreakable loving bond. When there is no struggle, there's no strength. So I think the lesson from the Lebos is no matter how tough it might be, or no matter how much it hurts at the moment, you'll look back and realize that it's the struggles that changed your life for the better. And you will reap the lasting benefits from getting through those tests in life. Oh, and another lesson from the Lebos. Booze helps.
In 2 hours, I have my bourbon, so I'm okay. 5 o'clock. Oh. You can stop in any day at 5 o'clock. We're sitting here with scotch and bourbon. And if people are here, vodka and whatever.
Well, we have every day at 5 o'clock. Happy hour. And I say, well, fantastic. Erwin told me I drink scotch and Judy drinks bourbon. And I say, fabulous. And I said, you can come over to my place and then we can have a happy hour.
And of course, despite all else, keeping busy and staying productive.
I volunteer at a thrift shop, the thrift shop for the mentally ill. But I've been working there for 20 years.
20 some odd years.
Since the store opened, I work every Tuesday afternoon. It's a very profitable store, and it's an exciting thing.
I've been on the board of Jewish Family Services for 30 years. This is my 30th year I'm going into now, and I'm going to brag again. I do a collection here in Hunter's Run annually called Project Hope, Help Our Poor and Elderly. And I started it 30 years ago to raise money for Jewish Family Services to provide food for Passover for people who needed help. And every year I have flyers printed up and we get one in each door. I have 12 volunteers that I've recruited through the years. And over 30 years, I have raised close to $400,000 for Jewish Family Service. So that's why they won't let me off the board.
I asked Magdalena, who is decades younger than the near 99 and the near 97-year-old Irwin and Judy, why she enjoys hanging out with them so much.
Is their spirit. They're young at heart.
I mean, even though you're driving and driving and working and playing tennis, is there anything you miss about being younger?
Not really.
I don't know if I can say this.
Forget it.
I'm Leslie Gold. Thank you for listening to A Life's Story. Hi, it's Leslie. As I create these episodes, I can't help but think of my own parents. They're gone now, and I wish I did this with them. I'd give just about anything to hear them tell their stories in their own voices again. And I thought, well, that's a service worth providing. So now you can get the full life story treatment for your loved one. We capture the life story of an important person in your life, say your parent or grandparent, and create a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that they will love and that you will treasure. You'll be proud to share it with your family, one day your kids and your grandkids. And the personal audio pieces include all the bells and whistles you hear in the podcast episodes. We do in-depth interviews, we score with music, use historical sound, we build a story arc, provide professional narration, and add additional voices. These pieces come out beautifully. And speaking from personal experience, one day you'll be really glad you have it. We are creating personal love stories too. So go to alifesstory.net for more information. alifesstory.net. You can book a call with us from the site and we can discuss who you have in mind for a personal project in a totally no pressure call. alifesstory.net.